Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. Today we have the pleasure to be joined by Sir Harpal Kumar, Chief Executive of Cancer Research UK, the world's largest independent cancer charity. Last year he chaired the Independent Cancer Task Force, and he will be discussing with us the key findings and implications of the Task Force report. We'll be talking in depth about the NHS's ambitions to achieve world-class cancer outcomes over the next 5 years and beyond. And that will include what the task force believes are vital improvements in early diagnosis, radiotherapy infrastructure, and the future of the Cancer Drugs Fund. Our interview complements an excellent and concise commentary piece he has written for our journal, which is definitely worth reading, and the full report itself is available freely online. But for now, our interview with Sir Harpal Kumar. Many thanks, Sir Harpal Kumar, for joining us today. And I'd like to start off by giving you many congratulations for being knighted in the New Year's Honours List of this year. Having prepared for my interview with you, prior to that being announced, actually, I was reading through the accomplishments that you've done. So it took me by no surprise that you were honoured in that way. So
that's very kind. Thank you.
So I just wanted to start off, actually, by asking you a little bit about Cancer Research UK and how you came about to be its chief executive. Mm-hmm. I understand you completed an undergraduate degree at the University of Cambridge mm-hmm. in chemical engineering, mm-hmm. but then your next step was to do an MBA at Harvard Business School. So what made you take that step?
Okay, so yes, I studied chemical engineering. I actually worked for a while as an engineer. I was sponsored by what was then the UK Atomic Energy Authority, and I worked for a while with them, actually including some research components. And then I ended up joining McKinsey as a management consultant out of Cambridge, and I worked there for a couple of years working in a range of different areas. And as is often the case for management consultants, they are keen for people to get an MBA. So they sponsored me to go to business school to get my MBA, which is what I did. And for me, it was an opportunity at that point to say that what I wanted to do was really to focus on healthcare as the industry that I was interested in, without extending it too much. I came close several times during my years at Cambridge to switching to medicine. It was something that I thought about very, very hard. But whilst I was a business school, I worked with a biotech company for a while out on the west coast of the States, and as it happens, working on cancer diagnostics. But what I concluded that I wanted to do after business school was really focus in on healthcare, and I went back to McKinsey, and almost all of my work was in areas like pharmaceuticals and working with some other major academic health centres across Europe.
And so what then brought you round to working for Cancer Research UK?
So I did a number of things. I ended up running a couple of other organisations, including running my own company for a while, which was in the area of physiological monitoring. And so most of what I'd been doing prior to joining Cancer Research UK was in the broad spectrum of healthcare technologies, not just pharmaceuticals, but also diagnostics and devices. And Cancer Research UK, as many people will know, came into being in 2002 through the merger of what used to be the Imperial Cancer Research Fund and the Cancer Research Campaign. They merged in 2002. Each of them had a subsidiary that was focused on commercialising technologies that result from research, so early drug discovery and so on. And I was recruited in to effectively bring those two subsidiaries together and run that for a while, which I did. And then, cut a long story short, I ended up getting more and more involved in the work of the charity and eventually becoming chief executive.
And CRUK is traditionally associated with fundraising and things like that, but it, as you've already touched on, it's a lot more to it than that. So can you tell us about the remit of CRUK as it stands right now?
Well, the remit of Cancer Research UK is very much about doing the research that enables us to make a difference in cancer outcomes. And the way we measure that, the way we think of ourselves as an organisation, is our objective is to reduce the number of people who die from cancer. And that is about doing the work so that as few people get it as possible. But then for those who do get it, how can we diagnose them more effectively? How can we improve the treatment? How can we make the treatments kinder, so that in the ultimate analysis, as few people die from it as possible? And that's, as I say, how we measure ourselves. Now, the predominant work we do is research, as it says on the tin. Mm. And that's a very broad spectrum of activity, through from the fundamental understanding of cancer. What is it? Why does it happen? What makes it spread? Why does it happen to some people and not others? Why do some people respond to treatments and not others? So really the sort of the core underpinning of what cancer is and its drivers. And then turning that understanding is to, okay, well, what can we do about preventing more cancers in the future? What can we do, as I say, to improve the processes by which we diagnose it, the technologies that we use? How can we improve the range of treatments that we have available? And indeed, how can we optimize the treatments we use for each individual patient so that all of that together is, if you like, our research agenda, which is where we spend 95%+ of our income. But it's important that we don't stop there. So we also then spend a fair bit of our time influencing the government and the NHS to put that into practice. So it's not sufficient for us to, for example, do the work that validates a new radiotherapy technique. Mm. We have to then make sure it's implemented in the NHS, because otherwise there's no point doing the research. And similarly, we provide quite a lot of information for patients and their families, everything from understanding risk factors for cancer to understanding symptoms to, once a patient's been diagnosed, what they want to understand, well, what are their treatment options and what questions should they be asking their doctors and so on. So there's a range of activity there, and more recently that's extended into working more at the frontline level in both primary and secondary care. So, for example, in primary care, we have a team of people that goes into GP practices, working with GPs to help them understand what's going on in their patch, for example, about areas like late diagnosis. Mm.
And during your time at CRUK, what do you think has been its biggest achievement?
Gosh, it would be impossible to pick on one. You know, I think I've been here 13 years now, and I could pick on any number of things, but the most important thing, going back to what I said earlier, is that survival rates continue to improve, and they improve every year, and they will continue to do so. And that is fueled by research. It's also fueled by more effective ways of delivering care to the patients. And that is not one thing that's delivered that. It is a whole series of sometimes big advances and sometimes rather incremental advances. But packaged together, they mean each year we're seeing improvements in what's being achieved, and hopefully that will continue. We've made progress on prevention. You know, tobacco smoking rates continue to come down, and we need to see them continue to come down further, for example. So it's a whole series of things rather than one thing that I would pick on. I suppose it's also important to say that cancer has remained high on the agenda of politicians. And I think that's really important, because actually it's really important for the public, really important for everyone in the health service. But if the politicians start to lose interest in it, then actually it wouldn't continue to get the investment it needs going forward. And that's certainly something we've been keen to see happen.
Absolutely. And that takes us nicely onto the Independent Cancer Task Force report. And you chaired that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a bit about the process of that, first of all. So how do you actually get involved with that? Did you receive an email or someone just taps you on the shoulder? What happened?
Yeah, so as an organisation, we will, as I was alluding to earlier, we will push and prod the government and the NHS into what we think are the important issues for them to be dealing with. And that could be everything from tobacco to radiotherapy machines, for example. And one of the things that we've been saying over the last year or two is that it was time for a new cancer strategy, a new cancer plan. So we've had three before, but the last one was written pre all of the NHS changes and pre things like the five-year forward view, and actually just in a very different context. And so it was time to have a new plan that took that new context into account, took all of the learnings that we've made over the last 5 or 10 years into account, and set out, if you like, what the priorities should be for the coming 5 years. So we had been pushing both the government and the leadership of the NHS to think about that. And I was actually in the States at a conference focused on earlier detection, actually. And I got a call from Simon Stevens saying that they'd been talking to the government and they had decided that it was time for a new cancer strategy, and would I chair a task force to do this. So we had a couple of conversations about it and I agreed to do it.
And as a chair of such a large task force, what is your role? What do you actually have to do?
It's what most people would expect would be involved in something like this. It's deciding, first of all, it's figuring out who should be on the task force with you. So we try to get a broad level of representation of the key professional disciplines, of patients, of charities, and so on, who could provide expert input into the work that we needed to do without it becoming so big that it was unwieldy. It was about saying, okay, well, what are the big questions we need to focus on? Gathering all of the evidence. So I didn't do all that myself, but, you know, we had a team of people working on it. We had something like 100 different meetings and workshops, and I didn't attend all of those, but I attended most of those. And that's really important because, as everyone listening to this will know, sometimes it's about the nuances of what happens on the ground that you really need to understand. And so it's gathering all that input over a period of 4 or 5 months. And what we would do at the task force itself is to debate what was emerging from those various workshops and the written evidence that was coming in and say, OK, well, what are the really high priority areas that we need to focus on? What ambitions do we want to set for the next 5 years? You know, what are the things that we think are really important for us to try and achieve over the next 5 years? And then in the final stages, it was about writing the thing, you know, and really that was myself and one other person who did the bulk of the writing and fine-tuning of it. And then it was about sort of sharing that with various people and sense-checking that and saying, are we on the right sort of track, or where we needed other pieces of information, you know, going and getting those pieces of information, putting the whole thing together and then launching it.
May I say, as a clinician, having read the report, it really hits the nail on the head on the real issues we do face over the next 5 years and beyond. So I must congratulate you on that. Just sort of introspectively, looking at the whole process, it must have been so complicated to bring all these things together. If you could go back in time, would you do anything differently?
Well, it's not so much that I would do things differently. It was done relatively quickly, so the whole process took just over 6 months, which is actually quite a short period for something of this breadth and complexity. And one of the things that was, as a consequence of that, where we might have wanted to gather some new pieces of evidence or commission some new data or research, actually we didn't have the time to do that. We were able to do some, but not as many as we would have liked to do. That said, in cancer we have a much bigger body of evidence than we do in most other disease areas. And so we already have a rich level of knowledge about what's going on. And yes, we had to pull all of that together, but a lot of it existed. So the point really was that it was being done, it was a relatively short period that we, so it was a very intense period to get that done. But that was important because one of my objectives was to get it done so that it fed into the spending review that was published last autumn, because I wanted to make sure that to the extent that we were calling for more investment in certain areas, that was done in time to be factored into the spending review. And so it was better for me and better for our work to get that done by early summer,
yeah, that makes sense,
rather than to take longer and run the risk that any investment needs wouldn't then be considered.
And the full report and the executive summary, it's all available online, and you've written a commentary piece for our journal that really summarises the key points. So we can't focus on everything today. Yep. I wanted to just drill down on a couple of things.
Yep.
Early diagnosis, clearly a very important thing, and you've identified that.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see some of the statistics you've quoted on that. And it will involve quite a lot of investment and things. Yep. So can you tell us a bit about why early diagnosis is important and how you're going to go about achieving this?
Yeah. So let's just reiterate why it's important first. So we know that for the vast majority of cancer types, if we can diagnose them at an earlier stage, the outcomes are very, very much better than if we diagnose them at a later stage, both in terms of survival outcomes, but actually also in terms of the cost of treating patients. And that's obviously very important in the current environment. So there is a massive gain to be had by being able to diagnose patients earlier, being able to get them into treatment options that are curative as much as possible. So that's why earlier diagnosis is important, and then, you know, different statistics and different cancer types that people will be very familiar with. We also know, though, from international comparison work we've done, that on average in Britain we tend to diagnose later than in other countries with which we would compare ourselves. And that is one of the principal drivers for why we have survival outcomes that are not as good. Closing the gap in breast cancer, we're not yet closing the gap, for example, in lung and colon cancer. And we can absolutely map that our average stage of diagnosis is later in those cancers than it is in other countries. And we also know that if we look just across the UK, or indeed just across England, there's huge variation. So in some parts of the country, if you look at the proportion of patients who are diagnosed at stages one or two, across all types of cancer, it's as high as sort of 70%. In other parts of the country, it's down at the sort of 50% levels. So there's a real opportunity here. And I'm very clear in my mind that in the next 5 years, the thing that could have the biggest transformational impact in terms of outcomes is if we could diagnose more patients earlier. And because some parts of the country can do it, we know that therefore it ought to be achievable across the board.
And one of the things you've suggested is that GPs having better access to important imaging investigations. That totally makes sense. But the naysayers would say, in terms of resource and funding, that where are we going to get the money from? Where are we going to get them?
So I alluded to this earlier, and again, it's a really important point that if we look at how much it costs to treat an early stage patient versus how much it costs to treat a late stage patient. So if we take colon cancer as an example, it costs somewhere between 3 and 4 times as much to treat a patient with advanced colon cancer as it does to treat a patient with early stage colon cancer. So there is an enormous saving to be generated if we can shift upstream. If we can shift to having more patients being diagnosed earlier. And we've done some analysis to quantify this, and we think that there's a net saving to be had here. But it requires investment at the upstream end. It requires investment in diagnostic capacity, which is, you know, radiology, endoscopy, pathology, and some extent in primary care. But if we make that investment, that we will deliver savings downstream, because we won't be spending as much treating advanced cancers. We have to make that investment in order to realise the savings. And that's one of the principal themes, if you like, that I was trying to convey through this strategy, was there are savings to be had, but we have to invest first in order to be able to achieve those savings. And in the case of diagnostic capacity, the principal deficit we have is in workforce. We don't have enough radiographers, we don't have enough endoscopists, we don't have enough radiologists. We need to invest in that workforce. We need more people.
And your conversations with politicians and policymakers, do you think we're going to get that investment?
I think the message has landed really clearly that earlier diagnosis is a principal priority and has to be a priority. I think everyone's got that message now. And I think everyone's got the message that we have to do more investigative testing in order to be able to deliver that. Now, the exact mechanisms by which we do that are going to differ in different parts of the country, and clearly that needs some further thought. But work is underway, and I'm confident that the messages have been heard. The area that I'm still worried about is the workforce piece. Not because the message hasn't been heard, but because it's such a tough problem to crack. And of course, it won't deliver in a 5-year time frame. It will deliver in a longer term time frame. So we have to do some short term things as well. But if we don't start working on the workforce problem now, we'll never get there. So we have to absolutely work on it. That's the area where I think we still need a lot more attention.
And workforce is a very topical issue at the moment with junior doctor strikes and whatnot. So do you have any observations on that? Do you think that's going to make your job harder?
Well, you know, I think anything that affects the morale of the workforce is not going to help. We need to be attracting more people into doing medicine, doing nursing, because we need more people. And we need people who are well skilled in what they're doing, which doesn't mean that the skill mix won't need to change. The skill mix will need to change. But, you know, we just need more people. And so anything that can help to, frankly, boost the attractiveness of medicine and nursing as careers is really important, and indeed other health professional roles as well. And that's why things like the strike are unhelpful.
Yeah, well, hopefully that will all improve. Let's see. I wanted to now focus a bit on the radiotherapy side of things, and you've covered it in great detail in your report. So can you tell us a bit more about the highlights of what you think should be happening to our radiotherapy centres?
Again, the first thing, which will be very well known to your listeners' ear is radiotherapy remains a mainstay of treatment. That is not well known by the public, and neither is it well known by politicians. But, you know, something around a half of all cancer patients will need radiotherapy. And so, as much as anything, we need to keep working between us on keeping that awareness high. Okay, so that having been said, there are two or three things that I think are really important. First is that our kit in the country, that the number of linacs we have and the state of the art of those linacs is not where it should be. And this won't be new to many of the people who are listening to this, but we have many linacs around the country that are reaching the end of their useful lives, and we need to be investing to put new machines in and to upgrade those machines that do exist. And we benefited 10 or so years ago from a massive investment in linacs. Well, of course, now we're reaching the end of lives of those linacs. So one of the things we've called for is a big capital fund to upgrade the radiotherapy kit around the country. We've estimated something of the order of 125 Linux will need replacing in the next 2 or 3 years, and about a further 50 or 60 will need upgrading. And that's really important so that we have access to not just kit that enables us to use the more advanced techniques, but also is more efficient in the way we can use it. Otherwise, we'll need more machines. So now, we haven't yet heard a commitment from the government that they'll do that, but I'm hopeful that they will. But we need to keep pushing on that. So that's one thing we need to have the kit. Second area is, of course, we need to keep doing the research that says, okay, which are the techniques that we need to be further understanding and then rolling out. So whether it's stereotactic radiotherapy, whether it's use of more advanced imaging techniques, whether it's soon to be research on protons and where we best use those, because actually the evidence base for some of those areas is not as rich as we need it to be. So we do need to continue to do the research that demonstrates where some of these new techniques can best be utilized, and frankly where we don't need to use them. So we need to have a system that can continue to encourage that work to happen and foster that work happening. We're still not, for example, where we need to be on IMRT. We've done a lot of work over the last 2 or 3 years, and we've come a long, long way. But we're still only at about 35% of patients having IMRT, and probably it should be more like 50%. So there's work to be done. But actually, if you look at how quickly that picture has changed, it shows that with a bit of concerted effort, we really can change things. So there's a number of areas there. And again, probably we need to do more on the clinical oncology workforce as well, and medical physics and radiography and so on, to support all of this, because we know that the demand is going to continue to grow.
I was reading in terms of the capital cost you mentioned. It's about $252 million just to replace the machines we've already got. We haven't got any agreement on that yet, but one of the strategies you recommended is having a central procurement, as that can save us significant money. So where is that going? And one thing with that, do you foresee then that all the hospitals and all the radiotherapy departments in the UK will have the same radiotherapy machines?
No, not necessarily, because let's face it, there aren't that many suppliers out there, so there aren't that many choices that are available to various hospitals around the country. But you know, what's absolutely clear is that if every hospital buys its linacs independently, it won't be able to negotiate the sorts of prices that can be negotiated if there's a more centralised procurement effort. And this isn't just true in the health service, this is true in every area of life. If you've got bigger buying power, you can negotiate big discounts. And absolutely this can be done with radiotherapy machines. There's no question about that at all. So to the extent that we can, through some sort of centralised procurement exercise, making sure that we get the best value for money for the NHS is why we've recommended doing it that way.
The Cancer Drugs Fund. Clearly that's something that's been very topical and is very important. Where do you see that going? Because it does seem to be a very short-term fix.
Yes, so we've been concerned for some time that it's been a sort of sticking plaster over a problem. So there are some new proposals out now. There's a consultation document out about how the Cancer Drugs Fund could evolve. And actually, we think those proposals are on the right sort of lines. And really, the fundamental issue has been that often a new drug can get a license, a marketing license, but when that drug is considered by NICE, The concern is that the data aren't necessarily mature enough for NICE to be able to recommend, given the price that's being asked for it to be a mainstream treatment available through the NHS. Sometimes it's because the survival data aren't mature enough or what have you. And in the past, what has happened is that NICE has only really ever had two options. It can either say yes or it can say no. And if the data are uncertain, NICE says no. Actually, what the new proposals do say is that, well, let's add a third category, which says something more to the effect of, well, we need to gather more data. Let's make the drug available to patients for the period during which we're gathering that data. Let's make that period time limited. And let's also say that we're only going to pay a certain amount of money for any drug during that period of time, so that there isn't this massive cost escalation that we've seen over the past few years. And I think these are the right sorts of principles for how we should move forward. Another area where it's really important is that increasingly drugs are indicated for smaller and smaller groups of patients, for example, subsets of a particular tumour type. But NICE has typically only looked at an indication that's more than 1,500 patients a year. So then there isn't a national reimbursement decision, and individual providers and commissioners struggle with knowing whether to commission a particular drug for a particular indication. So some of these things will be dealt with through the new processes as well. So we do think that things are moving in the right sort of direction. And of course, there are some very exciting new therapies coming in as well. Some of the new immune therapies look particularly exciting. So actually there's quite a lot happening on the drug scene in cancer right now.
The Cancer Task Force report is out there now. How is it going to be implemented? Are you going to be part of that?
Yes, so an implementation group has been set up. So Callie Palmer, who's the chief executive of the Marsden, has been appointed to be the National Cancer Director. And she will chair what she's calling a transformation board, which will involve representatives from each of the NHS arm's length bodies. So NHS England, Public Health England, Health Education England, and so on. And that will be the primary delivery group that works with providers and commissioners across the country. Separately, there will be what's called an independent advisory group that, if you like, holds a mirror up and says, okay, are we making enough progress? Are we moving quickly enough in the areas that are really high priority? And I'm going to chair that group. And so we will look at what's going on. And on that group, I will have representatives of the key professional bodies, such as the RCR, some charities and some patient representatives. And as I say, we will be looking at the progress that's being made or not made and say, OK, well, we are or we aren't moving fast enough. And this is what we would advise in terms of the key areas that need to be focused on.
And the political system in the UK is such that parties might change in less than 5 years or so. Mm. The Prime Minister will change. Is that something that worries you when you're trying to look at something so long-term, or do you think there's cross-party support for this?
Yeah, so there absolutely is cross-party support for this, and that was one of the key things I did. So before I embarked on this exercise, I talked not just to the existing government, but I talked to the Labour Party as well, and I said, look, I want this to be a cross-party strategy, not something that's seen as being of one government. And certainly the Labour Party have welcomed it and have welcomed the recommendations. And indeed, I was just with the Shadow Health Secretary this morning, and she's very much on board with the recommendations in the strategy and the priorities that are set out there. So I think it does have cross-party support, and that is really important. But for the next 5 years, or for the next 4 years at least, it's this government's responsibility to implement it.
And I'd like to have our final part of this interview focusing a little bit more on the translational and basics research mm-hmm. that CRUK is so mm-hmm. involved in. Mm-hmm. It's an exciting time for cancer research, without doubt. What is CRUK's role now over the next 5 years in trying to drive forward these basic and translational changes?
So we talked a bit about our spectrum of research right at the beginning, and I'm very excited about the era that we're in right now. There's so much happening in almost every area of activity, actually, and we understand so much more about cancer today than we did even 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. Now, there's still huge areas we don't yet understand. One of the areas that there's a lot of attention going on at the moment is looking at, for example, how we can combine radiotherapy with drugs to deliver optimal treatments for patients, whether that be radiosensitizing drugs or other sorts of approaches. So some really interesting work going on there, both at the translational clinical level and at the mechanistic level, to really understand where different treatments can be synergistic and why. There's a lot of work going on in trying to understand how we can stratify patient groups for different types of treatment, how we can personalize treatment much more. There's a lot of work going on in understanding some of the principles of the immune mechanisms that we're seeing these fantastic results in the clinic, but actually the underpinning science isn't that well developed yet, and we need to understand more about how the tumour interacts with the environment around it, with the immune system, with the host, and the various implications that flow from that in terms of what treatments we might or might not use. I think one of the really exciting areas that will develop over the next few years will be that around earlier detection. So we talked earlier about the pathways for earlier diagnosis, but actually in the next 5 or 10 years, I hope we will have better markers for detection that mean we can much more quickly run a set of tests that will enable us to determine whether a patient does or doesn't have cancer, with some of the markers that might be present in blood or urine or other samples that we will have access to, which is not in any way to obviate what we will need to do in imaging for a definitive diagnosis, but the extent to which some of those tests can enable us to move people more quickly through the system, I think, will be very beneficial. So there's a whole range of very, very exciting and interesting areas, all the way through, as I say, from very, very fundamental understanding into how we move into the clinic in various different areas.
And I know that you've been involved with developing the Francis Crick Institute that's not far from your office here in Angel. What are the aims and ambitions of that institute, and how will that benefit us in the UK?
Yeah, so the Francis Crick Institute, for those who aren't aware of it, it's going to be the biggest medical research institute, certainly in Europe, possibly in the world. It's going to have 1,600 scientists working in it, all under one roof. And the ethos is very much about collaboration. It's about collaboration across scientific disciplines, it's about collaboration across disease areas, and it's about saying that increasingly we understand that in order to tackle complex problems such as the ones we're dealing with in cancer, we don't just need biologists and clinicians, we also need physicists and engineers and mathematicians and computer scientists, and we need them all working together. And the way most universities are structured is to have them all in separate departments, and that doesn't necessarily foster the sort of scientific collaboration that we need to see to tackle some of the problems we need to tackle in the future. Equally, we know that there's so much that we learn through research in one disease area that actually might benefit other disease areas, and the extent to which we separate those in institutes or in departments means that we're not expediting that knowledge exchange. We're not fostering the rapid sharing of knowledge that will benefit patients across all disease areas. So the Crick Institute is going to look not just at cancer, it's going to look at infectious diseases, it's going to look at neurodegenerative diseases, it's going to look at respiratory diseases and cardiovascular diseases and so on. And it will come at them through a process of discovery-oriented research. But so, for example, one of the areas in which we know it will benefit cancer is we have fantastic immunology in the UK. Much of that over the years has been focused on the understanding of infectious diseases and how we treat infectious diseases. But actually, we want to bring some of that expertise to bear on the cancer problem and figuring out how we can develop vaccine strategies, for example, for cancer. And having some of those people working alongside some of our cancer biologists and clinicians will, we think, really benefit some of the ways in which we think about the cancer problem. And I could give you many, many other illustrations as well, but really the principle is about collaboration across science, across diseases, and indeed collaboration with industry, so that we get the best exchange of ideas that will then lead to faster development of new treatments or new diagnostic tests or what have you.
On that note, Sir Harpal Kumar, thank you so much for spending time with us and presenting so many engaging and important points. Thanks very much.
Thank you.